You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, August 12th, 2009, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me, as always, are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Happy Zara Day, everyone.
Happy what?
Happy Zara Day.
What is that?
Zara Day? Isn't Zara like a, it's a clothing store, right?
It's the apostle holiday of the apostle Zarathud.
Oh, did I miss that again?
On your Discordian calendar? Hello? Page 34 of your Principa Discordia? Come on, everyone.
Oh,
you guys,
Jesus.
You have a copy lying around, I'm sure.
I think it's on a stone tablet somewhere around here.
What is this thing? What are you talking about?
So Discordianism. It's a modern religion centered on the idea that chaos is all that there is. There is no disorder and order. There is only chaos. That's how it breaks down.
So what do these guys worship? Cthulhu or something?
Eris.
Cthulhu is the ultimate order, Steve.
The Greek mythological goddess of discord, of course.
Eris, yeah. Eris is the largest of the dwarf planets, and its moon is Dysnomia.
Yeah.
It's not chaotic enough, Steve, so I don't understand what you're saying.
Say it again, but chaotic-er.
Chaotic-er.
The Discordian calendar has 573-day seasons. Chaos, discord, confusion, bureaucracy, and the aftermath.
Did you say bureaucracy?
Yes. So throw away your Gregorian calendar and get yourself a Discordian calendar. It's much more fun.
Is it bureaucracy season again? Fetch my tie.
So, Jay, tell us about your trip to Sweden last week.
Yeah, so what I did was I posted on Facebook while I was out there, and I got a bunch of people to respond. I couldn't believe it. Like, there were people that that actually were in both the locations that I was. I met Arne and Gustav, and God, I hope I'm pronouncing your names right, guys. I'm sorry.
Probably not, but go ahead.
And they came to Thule. That's the company I work for. They came, and they hung out with us for a little bit there. They met my coworkers. And then they actually came out to lunch with us, which was pretty cool. We had a great talk, and it was really awesome meeting those guys. We took pictures, and I put those up on Facebook.
Oh, what'd you have for lunch?
We actually went to...
dig deep, Evan. Yeah. Master and interviewer.
And I'm answering the stupid question. Anyway.
Yeah, you're like, well, some loot fish.
Well, you know, I had some of this. Get out
there. You had meatballs. Move on.
And then...
Oh God!
This couple that lives in Malmo, which is in southern Sweden, they're about to have a baby. So it ends up that the husband could only come out, and his name was Damien, and the wife's name is Marin. And I had a great time meeting those people. It was awesome. It's so cool that I could go to a country like that and have people that I can meet up with. I loved it.
And Jay, yesterday was your birthday.
Yeah, and yeah, it's pretty.
Right. Happy birthday!
Thank you, guys.
Happy day
Happy
after
birthday.
Your birthday.
I'm not young at all anymore. Like, that's over.
You're only as young as you feel or something. I don't know.
You're saying evolution is done with you?
Yeah, right?
As usual, Jay's birthday coincided with the peak Perseid meteor shower, which
right.
was yes. Yet again, but not quite as much of a disappointment as it's been for the past 15 years for where we live. I did actually see a few meteors with my daughter and her friend, and it was really cool to see their reactions.
I'll tell you guys, though, Bob is so dedicated that every year he actually does get up at like 2 and 3 in the morning when it's at peak dark time, and he goes out to take a look.
Well, you know, it wasn't just the Perseids on Jay's birthday, but it was also the night that Saturn's rings disappeared. Did you guys hear about this?
What
happened?
It's,
no.
It's John, Saturn's, right? It's at John
it,
now.
It was Saturn's equinox, which is a time of year when I'll probably get this wrong, but I believe that it's the sun is no longer able to reflect light off of the rings, and from our perspective, it looks as though the rings disappear.
Yeah, and some believe that during the Saturnian equinox, you can stand an onion ring on its edge.
Oh, I see what you did there. Wasn't actually funny.
That's been so discredited.
Oh, God.
Well, we do have a few news items for this evening. The first news item is an astronomical one. This is about the NASA satellite Kepler. Now, Kepler is a planet hunter. The way this satellite works is it looks at many, many stars at once, measuring the amount of light coming from those stars, and it's looking for systems, for stellar systems that have planets that orbit their star in the same plane as the view from Earth, so that the planet will pass in front of and then behind of, and then behind its star. When this happens, this is called the transit method, yes, of planet hunting. When this happens, the amount of light that we will detect from that star will dip.
Yeah, because the planet is obscuring part of the light.
That's right. Very tiny solar eclipse.
So if you have a, say, imagine a Jupiter-sized planet passing in front of a star, it eclipses the light coming from that star. So there would be a tiny dip in the amount of light that's coming. And then as it completes its transit, then the light will come back up. In addition to that, the light will dip when the planet goes behind the star. Do you guys know why that is?
The light dips.
Wait, when the planet goes behind the star, the brightness dips a bit?
Right. Well, because the planet also reflects light from the sun. So, and you lose that little bit of extra light that's being reflected off the planet when it goes behind the star. In fact, Kepler is so sensitive that it can measure the continually changing amount of light from the phases of the planet as it revolves around its star. So you see it slowly decrease as it becomes you have a full planet, as it were, going to less and less of it be reflecting light to the Earth, and then a big dip as it transits, and then as it completes its transit, the dip comes up again, and then it increases slowly as the planet reflects more light, and then you get another dip as it passes behind the planet. However, you have to wait for the period of this rotation to repeat itself at least twice, because you need at least two intervals in order to say that the interval is the same, right? So let's say, for example, that we have an Earth-sized planet orbiting at an Earth-like distance from a star, a distance that makes it revolve about its star once per Earth year. It would take at least 2 years for us to capture three transits, and then we could say that the interval between transit one and two was exactly a year, and then between two and three was exactly a year, that they were the same, that they were the same exact amount of time. Then we know we're dealing with a regular process, like a planet revolving around a star, because there are other processes apparently that could change the amount of light that we might be seeing from a star. So to prove that it's actually a planet revolving about the star, we need to capture those different intervals to make sure that they're the same. That's periodic. So the news is that Kepler has passed its first test. They pointed it at a star that's known to have a planet to see if that, and also that's known to have a planet with a very short period of only a few days, 2.5 days. And Kepler was able to see that the changing light over time, as I described, consistent with the changing phases of the planet and then the transit in front of and then behind its star. So that was a proof that Kepler is working and that this method works. Now we just have to point it out there, look at a bunch of stars, and start finding planets. Kepler's going to start finding a ton of planets over the next few years.
Is this also a way for the scientists to measure the size of the planet that's moving in front of the star?
Assuming you know the distance from the planet to the star.
Well, you can infer that from the period, which gives you the distance from the star, and therefore you could tell how big it is based upon the amount of light that it is obscuring.
Steve, can they determine the kind of makeup that the planet is, like what kind of atmosphere it has and if there's water on it?
Well, yeah, they can do spectroscopy on the light that's passing through the atmosphere of the planet on its way to us. So pretty tricky, but theoretically they can get information about what kind of stuff is in the atmosphere of the planet.
Yeah, I don't see why not. If you're intercepting the light, then yeah, you should be able to see what the chemical composition was.
And of course, the holy grail of all this planet hunting is to find a really Earth-like planet, Earth size at an Earth-like distance, and the so-called Goldilocks zone that actually has liquid water, and then look for things like oxygen and methane in the atmosphere.
Maybe even an opposite world where it's just like us, only everybody has goatees.
God, yeah. That'd be so cool.
Even the women?
I would love to see someone take pictures of us and turn us into like the evil version of ourselves.
Yeah. Yeah, but what if we're evil now?
I'd look like Ben Stein.
That's true.
Yeah, we all run soup kitchens and donate our time.
Like in South Park, Cartman's evil twin was this really good kid.
Oh, God.
That was so good.
That was the Simpsons joke, too, in A Treehouse of Horror, where Bart's evil twin was kept in the attic for all those years, and then they brought him out and realized that they had locked up the wrong twin.
it's a wonderful reoccurring theme in the world of cartoons.
Yeah.
Let's go on to the next news item. We have previously reported the interesting finding of methane in the atmosphere of Mars. Now, this is interesting because methane is a highly reactive compound that will not hang around for a long period of time in an atmosphere. It's just too reactive. So if we see a substantial amount of it, it must be being made somehow. So either that means that Mars has some geological activity and methane's being released from subsurface pockets. Or
space farts.
Yeah, right, farting aliens. Or that there are little microbes on Mars that are cranking out methane and replenishing the supply of methane in the Martian atmosphere. Now, the update is that astronomers have discovered that the methane on Mars has a much shorter life expectancy than they had previously thought. They have done some computer modeling of known processes, and according to the current models, the methane on Mars would only last 1/600th as long as they thought. That means that it's probably a much more recent phenomenon than we thought, or that there are some other processes involved that we're not aware of, or that the methane is being replenished at a much higher rate than we had previously thought. So,
does that mean it's turning into something else? It's breaking down into more basic.
Something is going on that we are not aware of.
So if the methane is disappearing much more quickly than we anticipated, of course that also means that it's also being created much more quickly than we anticipated. So it's a real mystery. That's going on there. The model does not match up. The computer model that these scientists have published in Nature, it's Frank Lefebvre and Francois, I forget his last name. How did I forget that? Oh, his last name is Forget, Forget. I guess you pronounce Forget.
Forget.
The first one, Lefebvre.
It's not as funny as Francois Forget. Lefebvre, he told...
Oh, boy. We're going to get a note from these guys. All right.
He told BBC News, we put the dynamics and chemistry as we know it in the model and tried to match the measurements to reproduce the uneven distribution they saw from Earth. The problem is they can't take into account the photochemistry as we know it on Earth. And if we put it in the model, then we can't reproduce the model. And that was a big surprise. So there's something there. There's something going on. They're not sure of the chemistry in the atmosphere on Mars or the interaction with the geology. Something really weird is going on. Hopefully, maybe in December, they're going to do some adaptive optics surveys of Mars again to try to, at the very least, replicate the previous finding, because you always want to replicate it. Who knows what happened the first time. If you could duplicate it, then you know, okay, this is fairly likely now. It's probably reality, and let's really start digging away at this. Or perhaps they'll find some new piece of the puzzle this December. And if that doesn't work, then they've actually got a pretty cool probe going there in the next year or so. That a really big boy maybe they could find something once they get on the ground.
You know, it's always weird to me to hear something that happened fast that has to do with the cosmos. You know, like methane is all of a sudden like having a massive change on Mars. That's weird.
Well, the thing is, whatever we're seeing now on Mars doesn't have to be a process that has been going on for a very, very long time or is always present on Mars. For example, there could have been a volcanic eruption a million years ago or 10 million
right.
years ago that put a lot of methane in the atmosphere, which is now rapidly deteriorating, for example. Well, Bob, tell us about a recent breakthrough in multiple sclerosis research.
Yeah, I know this is kind of your domain, Steve, but I'm going to give it a shot. And I thought it was a very interesting story, incredible potential from reading it right. It's funny. I love these potentially significant findings or inventions in science that nobody really saw it coming. My favorite being Edison's invention of recording audio that from what I've been able to read, nobody saw that coming. So this is kind of what happened with this latest news item that I'm going to talk about. Now, these are some scientists at the, I'm taking a deep breath, the Jewish General Hospital Lady Davis Institute for Medical Research at McGill University in Montreal. Oh. Using an unanticipated discovery, they were able to completely reverse multiple sclerosis in mice. Now, multiple sclerosis, I'm sure you've all heard of it. Just a few details in case you're a little fuzzy on exactly what was going on. It's an autoimmune disorder where the body behaves pretty much like it's allergic to itself. With MS specifically, the insulating sheath that covers your nerves, myelin, is being attacked. And when that's being attacked, the communication between your brain and other parts of your body are disturbed and can cause a whole host of problems.
But to be clear, multiple sclerosis affects the central nervous system, the neurons and axons in the brain and spinal cord. It does not affect typically the peripheral nerves.
Now, many people are affected by this, but a lot of people, it's pretty mild. I wasn't aware of that. I thought if you had it, you're in for a hell of a ride. But for a lot of people, it's mild.
Well, yeah. In fact, MS runs the entire spectrum. In fact, there are people who we only make the diagnosis at autopsy when we're doing an autopsy on the brain tissue. We slice it open and we see that there were MS plaques there.
Wow.
But they never had any symptoms of MS. They were asymptomatic. So that's the mildest end of the spectrum.
Wow.
But at the severe end of the spectrum, you can be pretty debilitated within even a couple of years.
Yeah, and that includes you can't write, you can't speak, or you can't even walk. So now we're talking about in the United States, I guess it's pretty hard to determine, give an exact number, but anywhere from 250,000 to 350,000 people in the United States which are afflicted. Now, Dr. Jacques Galipeau, he's a world-renowned expert on cell regeneration. And he was the lead for the team that made this discovery. And they named their treatment, they gave it an unusual name. It's called GIFT-15. This isn't a chemical pharmaceutical, which is what I guess is usually used for therapies to suppress immunity. This is more of a personalized or tailored form of cellular therapy, which uses the patient's own cells. Now, GIFT-15, this stuff seems pretty amazing. It's basically a lab-fused protein. It's two proteins that are fused together in a lab. One protein is GSM-CSF, and another is interleukin-15, which are proteins that actually stimulate the immune system. The weird thing is, though, when you get these guys together and fuse them together, they do the exact opposite. They suppress the immune system, and I don't think anybody specifically saw that one coming.
Well, I mean, to put this into perspective, we know the immune system is extremely complicated. There are different kinds of white cells and other types of immune cells. Some act to target and stimulate the immune system. Others act to put the brakes on to suppress the immune system. So we know that these mechanisms are there. I don't think it's really fair to say this, that nobody saw this coming. This is exactly the kind of thing that immunologists are trying to figure out, how to manipulate the immune system to suppress those parts that we want to.
They actually take these two fused proteins, fusokine. I never saw that. Have you heard of that term, Steve? F-U-S-O-K-I-N-E. It's a combination of fusion and cytokine. But they took this fusokine. I think that's how you pronounce it. They take that and they put it on the B cells, and that's what kind of morphs these B cells, which are essentially white blood cells that create antibodies. It morphs them into this new beast. Galipeau described it this way. He said that GIFT-15 can take your normal run-of-the-mill B cells and convert them in a Superman or Jekyll and Hyde sort of way into these super powerful B regulatory cells. We could do that in a petri dish, he says. We took normal B cells from mice and sprinkled GIFT-15 on them, which led to this Jekyll and Hyde effect. And when we gave them back intravenously to mice, that are ill with multiple sclerosis, the disease went away.
Well, another point of clarification, EAE, or experimental allergic encephalomyelitis, is not MS. It's an animal model we use to study a disease like MS. So it's similar enough that it's a useful animal model or something that we can use for research. What they actually do is they inject mice with myelin, with the protein that coats sheaths of nerves and axons to make them conduct better. And that induces an allergic reaction in the mice to the myelin, producing a disease similar to MS. And again, enough so that it could be an experimental model.
Right. Okay. Yeah, that was one concern then as soon as I read that it's not really MS. It's really my research said it's experimental autoimmune encephalomyelitis. So that my first thought is, well, how close is it to MS? you know, maybe it works in this bizarre, you know, lab-induced form, but for humans it won't. And that's the big if, anyway, translating it to people.
Well, the model EAE has been around for years and years, so we've done a lot of research on it. It is the standard experimental model for MS, or animal model. So, yes, absolutely has to be translated into human research. You can't take it for granted that it will work, but we do have a lot of experience with this model, and it's pretty good.
Okay, that's good to know.
Yeah, I couldn't really tell in the article I read whether or not they were exaggerating, whether the science reporter was sort of exaggerating the results, but they were basically reporting that the chances of this working in humans exactly the way it works in these mice is very high, which struck me as being very odd and seeming a little optimistic. But it, you know, obviously it would be a huge boon if it does, and I think it would have interesting effects on animal research. I think it'll, you know, probably give a lot more ammunition to the scientists who are fighting to keep animal research, you know, as an option.
And it's also important to point out, though, that this isn't just some potential cure maybe for MS, but really any autoimmune disorders this could help for. Crohn's disease, lupus, even arthritis. Imagine no more arthritis. And another obvious application, of course, would be controlling immunity for organ transplant patients. That's another
one. Wow, that would be incredible.
So this is a very interesting breakthrough. It's one of those very exciting basic science breakthroughs that can potentially have a lot of clinical applications. Of course, it'll take years to really see what its effects are. But we have to add the caution that this is still needs to be tested in specific clinical applications in humans, and it will take a long time to figure out what its real effects are. And, you know, the immune system is really complicated. We are learning new and more subtle and nuanced ways to manipulate it. You know, we want to be able to suppress a specific part of the immune system so that we can significantly reduce or turn off an either rejection of a transplant or an autoimmune disease without making somebody completely immunocompromised, right, and susceptible to infections and stuff. There is, for example, a relatively new drug for MS called Tysabri, which also is, you know, a new fancy way of suppressing the immune system, extremely effective. I mean, you know, in clinical trials in humans, it really significantly reduces the number of exacerbations of MS. Unfortunately, its launch was delayed because of a couple of cases of a very bad neurological disease called PML, which results from a virus that normally lays dormant in the brain, in the nervous system, causing an infection. So that's exactly what we don't want to happen from suppressing the immune system, allowing an infection to rage and cause damage to the brain. This is still a rare complication of this drug, but it's a very serious one. And the drug is in use now just with caution, but that's a risk now you got to take. So it's hard. We're still trying to get that magic bullet with the immune system where we can turn off just the parts we want with minimizing or without, you know, opening the host up to infections. So that all has to be seen, you know, how that's going to play out with these kind of treatments in humans. The last news item is one I blogged about on Science-Based Medicine today. And this is a very interesting new phase in the regulation of alternative medicine. This is a report put out by the King's Fund, which is a UK-based charity. Again, meaning they use the term charity there to mean nonprofit. Mm-hmm. And they put together a committee to look at essentially the evidence for complementary and alternative medicine modalities. And the recommendations that they came out with, in my opinion, are absolutely horrific. Here's an excerpt taken from their press release. They say that this is Professor Dame Carol Black, who was the head of this commission. It has become widely accepted that a stronger evidence base is needed if we are to reach a better understanding of complementary practices and ensure greater confidence in their clinical and cost effectiveness. The challenge is to develop methods of research that allow us to assess the value of an approach that seeks to integrate the physical intervention, the personal context in which it is given, and nonspecific effects that together comprise a particular therapy. Now, that is all a very obscure way of saying that they are specifically looking for evidence to validate these modalities, and that they want to consider the non-specific effects that they want to consider are things that would be otherwise labeled as placebo effects in a scientific clinical trial. In effect, what they want to do is say that, like, for example, we talked recently about the acupuncture study that showed that placebo acupuncture was no better than so-called real acupuncture. They want to be able to say, well, there you go. The effects of the placebo acupuncture should count as real effects. Those are non-specific effects of the therapeutic intervention.
Heads we win, tails you lose.
Yeah, well, heads we win, tails we win. It's exactly. So what they're doing is, you know, again, is using this very deceptive, subtle kind of rephrasing of how they're approaching evidence and how they're looking at evidence in order to get away from scientific clinical trials that are designed to determine if a treatment works. That's been the gold standard, right? Of medicine. We want to know that our treatments actually are having an effect, that they're doing something, that they work. They're getting away from those trials because they're frustratingly not validating their precious, you know, preferred complementary modalities. So they're trying to go to so-called pragmatic studies. Now, pragmatic studies have historically been used to say, all right, we have these proven therapies. Let's see which ones are more useful or convenient in the real-world settings and which ones are more cost-effective. Those kind of trials have not been used to decide if something works or not, right? And now they're trying to say that if, like, a homeopathic remedy has only placebo effects, that's okay because there's a benefit to the non-specific effects of the therapeutic intervention with the homeopath. So it doesn't matter that double-blind, you know, placebo-controlled trials show that homeopathic remedies are no better than placebo. That doesn't mean they don't work. It just means they have non-specific effects.
Yeah, I mean, they're basically just validating anecdotes.
They're cheating.
Turning an anecdote into something that they can call science.
Absolutely. They're completely trying to turn the very way in which we use evidence and science on its head to say that whatever happens, it's all good. If a study shows that it works, then it works. If it shows that it doesn't work, well then, if that it's no better than placebo, let's say, well then that's okay. The placebo effect is still in effect and that's a non-specific therapeutic effect. And that should be used in order to get the government to pay for these treatments, which is the ultimate, the bottom line of this recommendation. It's total crap. It is the elimination of science as the determination of the standard of care in medicine. That's what they want. They don't come right out and say it, but that's when you read between the lines and when you read how they're actually interpreting these things, all this gobbledygook they're saying ultimately results in we want to eliminate the science as the basis of the standard of care because science won't necessarily validate the stuff that we want to do. We don't want to take our chances and let the chips fall where they may, right? With regular medicine, if science shows that it works, then we use it. If it shows that it doesn't work, then it gets thrown on the trash heap. Although I will point out that that's not perfect and that even within mainstream medicine, there are those who cling to a modality beyond the evidence and sometimes even in the face of negative evidence, but not forever, right? That eventually the process works its way through and treatments that are not supported by evidence get discarded. In CAM, though, they are insulating themselves from the scientific evidence as much as possible. They don't want the chips to fall where they may. They want them to only fall in their favor. And that's why it's totally broken as a system.
Is this going to take hold, Steve? Does this have real legs? And
does. It does, because the media laps it up completely uncritically. I read little to no criticism within the mainstream media. Although the reports of this in the UK, one good thing is that Edzard Ernst almost ubiquitously gets quoted, although it's the token skepticism, and he said the exact right thing, that this is a backdoor double standard, right, which is exactly correct. So occasionally we get the token skepticism in there, but largely the media, they haven't caught on, you know, and the CAM proponents are very savvy in their newspeak marketing lingo. They're really doing a good job of twisting the language.
Yeah, are they taking pointers from the creationists or something?
Oh, yeah.
It certainly sounds like they're just trying to it like wedge their craziness into the mainstream any way that they can. And they do it by obfuscating language and basically confusing the issues until people don't know what's science anymore.
Exactly. It's a very apt comparison. I've written multiple blog entries making the comparison between creationism and so-called complementary alternative medicine, as many people are promoting it because of that very thing. They also, another similarity is that they trade on the notion of academic freedom or freedom, right? So the intelligent designers want to use the notion of academic freedom to remove the standard of education and science, right, within universities. And CAM proponents want to use healthcare freedom as a way of removing the scientific standard to keep them from doing what they want to do. So there's a lot of parallels. Of course, the CAM proponents don't want to hear that, right? But the analogy is very, very apt.
Do they have an effective lobby, Steve?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, they have infiltrated every level of the regulation of medicine, very effectively. It's amazing how effective they've been. But it's all based upon this kind of thing. It's like, oh, gee, you know, the research isn't showing that our therapies work. Well, what are we going to do with that? Okay, well, let's come up with this elaborate, deceptive justification for relying upon the crappy research, because we can make that show whatever we want it to show. But it's really ridiculous. Well, let's go on to some of your emails. The first email comes from Guy, that's the only name that he gave, from Sherman Oaks, California. And Guy writes, I know you guys don't like getting into politics, but I think this ought to be discussed on the show. Ever since the U.S. presidential election last year, there has been a conspiracy theory circling around that President Barack Obama was not born in the U.S. and therefore cannot legally be president. This movement is nicknamed the Birther Movement. It has been compared to the 9/11 Truther Movement. Like 9/11 conspiracy theories, which have been discussed on your show before, this topic has less to do with politics and more to do with evidence and malicious lies. Could you discuss the genesis and development of this movement? Thanks. Yeah, this is interesting. I don't know if you guys have read a lot about this or not. But,
I know about this, yeah.
How have I read about anything else? It's everywhere. It's annoying.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the claim is that Barack Obama was not born in the United States, therefore he is not a natural citizen of the United States. And according to the U.S. Constitution, he would not be eligible to be president of the United States. So these are people who are basically trying to say that his presidency is not legitimate.
But the state of Hawaii has certified that he was born there.
Yes. I mean,
and they've done it on multiple occasions.
Right. The state of Hawaii has shown his birth certificate, and they've given out the birth.
Well, I don't know that they showed the certificate, Rebecca. They released it.
They did.
Was it the actual certificate?
It was a copy of the record.
I thought they didn't have the original or something. It was.
Nope.
And that's the margin of controversy, right?
That's what I'm getting to. Yeah, they do have the original, but in the state of Hawaii, it's against the law to release a birth certificate. But they have shown the birth certificate to several media outlets that have reported on it quite truthfully that, yes, it exists, but they are not legally allowed to release it to the world at large.
Without the president's permission?
I think they're not allowed to at all. They can't just hand out the original of his birth certificate.
So the only way to get the original, even if you're President Obama and you request the original, you can't get it, I would imagine is the case.
That's my understanding.
Yeah, they send you a copy, which is what they did.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly. And so, the governor of the state of Hawaii has verified that there is an original birth certificate, that it does exist. And yes, the copy has been released. But the thing is, none of that matters to the birthers. They're right. Much like the 9/11 truthers, yeah. They'll just adapt their strategies and come up with new ideas for why Obama isn't eligible to be the president. Another theory floating around is that he couldn't be president because his father wasn't a citizen, but they were basically just misreading the law. And when they brought their lawsuits about that, they were quickly thrown out of court because they're just not valid.
Surprised they even brought that as a lawsuit. That's pretty basic.
I
understand that, and I'm not a lawyer.
It's all remarkably transparent. Like, it's one of those things where if you were baffled by how persistent the 9/11 truthers have been. This, I think, is even more over the top, because you're talking about one issue that is so obviously, you know, it's debunked. Mm-hmm. Like, this has been so thoroughly debunked. But I think that that just doesn't matter to these people. Yeah. And
yeah, there's not as much noise in the evidence here as there is with 9/11. 9/11 was a very complicated event with lots of stuff going on.
Oh, yeah.
Lots of moving parts. This is very straightforward. Here's the birth certificate. Here's the copy. The original's been validated. Hawaii says it's legitimate. And his birth was announced in the two main newspapers of Honolulu. Those records exist. There was an eyewitness who's still alive who came forward and said, yes, I remember the day that he was born. So all the kinds of evidence that you would expect to be there are there, of course. Conspiracy theorists just say that's all fabricated. Yep. They can dismiss any evidence that contradicts them.
Also, Steve, I don't know if this is a reasonable line of thinking, but I tend to think of things along these lines. If it was possible to prove that he wasn't born in the United States, the Republican Party would have done it, because that would serve their end, right? That's what they want.
Not just the Republican Party. For me, one of the most compelling arguments is Hillary Clinton.
Mm-hmm.
She, I am sure she put a team of guys on this and spent a few dollars thoroughly looking into this, because this would have wiped away her only real challenge.
She would be president right now if she could prove it.
She would be president right now. Talk about motivation. If she didn't run with this, then
that's
pretty good. And even Ann Coulter.
Yeah, this is
one.
So crazy.
Come
Ann
on.
Coulter.
Well.
Now, there's the what some sites are calling the de facto movement leader, Orly Tate, has recently released a photo that is supposed to be Barack Obama's Kenyan birth certificate. Have you guys seen this?
No.
No. Now, this is it's again, even though it's an obvious forgery, it's fun to to evaluate evidence and this is, you know, it's a document. It's whatever it is, 40 something years old. So that creates certain ways to evaluate it. The best things I think that were discovered about it, one is that the document lists gives the name of Kenya as the Republic of Kenya. Turns out that it was the Dominion of Kenya until December of 64, and this document is dated from February of 64. So before the name actually changed over.
I'll just say it was leftover stationery from the last.
No. It's the new name. It was prematurely using the new name.
Right. You can't do. Yeah, that's right. They don't have a time machine, so they can't do
but
that.
They come back and say that Kenya had already renamed itself the Republic of Kenya. But it didn't.
Well, they also got Barack Obama's father's age wrong on it.
That's right.
Oops.
I mean, basic things. Come on, if you're going to forge a document.
But to complete that point, their counter argument was that the revolution occurred in 63, and they already in their constitution or whatever said they were the Republic of Kenya, but they didn't officially adopt the name on their documents until December of 64, and Kenyan historians and experts say that if you examine birth certificates from the same period of time, they don't use the Republic of Kenya until December of 64, and also. The other anachronism in the document was referring to the region of Kenya as a province, when at the time they were referred to as regions. So again, they made a couple of screw-ups on terminology like that, and there were some anachronisms in the document that completely invalidate it. It's a fake.
Which isn't really shocking, considering that Orly Tate's is batty. I kind of feel sorry for that, and that these mainstream media outlets are putting her out there. And
it's a freak show at this
point. It gets them eyeballs, and it gets them money,
that's
so
sad.
They do it.
I know.
Well, we're going to do one more email, and this one is a Name That Logical Fallacy. We haven't done this in a while. This one comes from Fred Lundrovich. I'm sorry if I mispronounced that last name, from Auckland, New Zealand, from down under.
And he's a Kiwi.
He's a Kiwi. And Fred writes.
Right. There you go.
Hey, guys. Thanks for being the best and most informative podcast in the observable universe.
Ooh, I like that.
Oh, wow. Thank you, Fred.
Well done.
I have an example of homeopathy apologetics that I guarantee will arouse the bullcrap meter in all of you. I thought this might make a great Name That Logical Fallacy segment. Anyway, here is a quote about why homeopathy is scientific. So I'm gonna, this is kind of long, so I'm just going to pull out a couple of things from this. The first one is this. Although homeopaths may not understand how their medicines work, keep in mind that leading contemporary pharmacologists readily acknowledge that there are many commonly prescribed drugs today, including aspirin and certain antibiotics, whose mechanism of action remains unknown. But this gap in knowledge has yet to stop physicians from prescribing them. So what's the logical fallacy ignorance. Or fallacies in that?
That's wrong on so many levels. But straw man, it's pretty much a straw man. If you're characterizing the argument as that not knowing how it works, the main problem skeptics have with this is not only does the mechanism completely implausible, but there's no evidence that it works anyway. So it fails on both counts.
I think that there are a couple of straw men in there. That's one. The other one is that skeptics will not accept the evidence that something works without also knowing how it works.
Right. Right,
which I think what you were getting at. But I think the primary logical fallacy here is a false analogy. The false analogy is between not understanding the precise mechanism of aspirin and certain antibiotics versus not understanding how homeopathy could work within the laws of physics, right? I mean, there are the difference in lack of plausibility or lack of understanding how something could possibly work is so completely different that you really cannot draw a meaningful analogy between the two, right? That's the core fallacy of that statement. It also contains a misstatement of fact in that we have a lot of knowledge about how aspirin works. 100 years ago. So he's actually, the argument was 100 years ago we didn't know how aspirin worked. Here's one more piece from this. The biomedical paradigm has narrowed the view of the thinking about and the practice of medicine to the treatment of specific disease entities with supposedly symptom-specific drugs and procedures. An integral aspect of this approach to medicine is the assumption that the larger the dose of a drug, the stronger will be its effects. While this seems to make sense on the surface, knowledgeable physicians and pharmacologists know that it isn't true. There is a recognized principle in pharmacology called the biphasic response of drugs. Rather than a drug simply having increased effects as its dose becomes larger, research has consistently shown that exceedingly small doses of a substance will have the opposite effects of large doses. That's the logical fallacy of completely making up bullshit and pulling it out of your ass.
And even exceedingly small doses doesn't really do justice to what the doses are being claimed with homeopathy, right?
Right, so that's another false analogy. There's a lot I could say about this, but just suffice to say, this is the opposite from the truth. In fact, there is this principle of mass action in that a chemical reaction or any kind of biochemical interaction will have a greater rate the greater the concentration of the reactant, of the thing that's undergoing the reaction, i.e. the drug. There are some special situations in which different doses can have different biological effects because of their affinities for various receptors and such, but there's no principle that says that it has the opposite reaction at low doses. That's all made-up fantasy nonsense. So thanks for that, Fred. That was a fun one. Well, let's go on with our interview. Well, we are at TAM7, and we are sitting here with Michael Goudeau. Michael, welcome to The Skeptic's Guide.
Thank you, guys. Appreciate it.
And you were on the anti-vax panel with me and some others yesterday. I think that was
a great job. Thank you.
It was very well received, you as well. So why were you on that panel? Why don't you tell us?
Oh, you know what? I have a 9-year-old son with autism, and I think I'm really the cheerleader for science at this point.
Yeah.
And so I went up there and went, yeah, what they said. That was my job. Right on, man.
It was succinct.
Succinct.
And to the point, and you know, frankly, you're in a position where you can say, you know, certain things that other professionals don't have the liberty to say. So no, it's important, I think.
Yeah, you know, I have an emotional attachment to the issue that a lot of people don't. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Yes, it's fine to be a doctor and outraged by this, but when you have a kid who's actually got it, it's a little different story.
Yeah.
You know, it's been fine. Yeah. You know, we're going forward because autism is now defined as a spectrum disorder. Many people who traditionally would claim autism would say he's not. But the medical society here has said the diagnosed him was autistic. So. Mm-hmm.
But it is a very, very broad spectrum.
I think traditionally it wasn't, and I don't I haven't read enough on why they've changed
it. It was just different diagnoses, like Asperger's syndrome,
sure.
which is considered to be a quote-unquote mild form of autism, is now considered part of the spectrum. So
right.
It's just multiple different entities. They said, yeah, it's actually all part of the same thing. It's really just a categorization diagnostic thing. It doesn't really necessarily mean anything.
Isn't that a very key point? Because a lot of these people are saying, why has autism rates risen? And it's not because of thimerosal or other things. But part of the reason is because the way it's classified, more people are being diagnosed with it.
Yeah, we've expanded the definition of what it is. And so many, many more people fall under that definition. Who traditionally, you would have just gone, well, that's something wrong with that kid. You know what I mean?
And I think this is, parents like you are important to get involved with this because the anti-vaccination movement has really sidled up to the autism community and tried to, claim, basically they're taking all the oxygen out of the room of the autism community on this, what we think is a distraction about this link between vaccines and autism. And we need to get more people, more parents and people in the autism community to say, wait a minute, we want to focus on something that's actually going to help, not this distraction.
Yeah, it's really easy to get parents yelling about their own children. And, I have trouble talking about it without breaking up about it.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you drag the parents into that, they can shout, oh, my gosh, this vaccine has given my child autism. People are eager to find some reason, something that could have possibly caused this in their child.
Mm-hmm.
And that's very understandable. It's wrong. They're wrong about what caused it. But, it's hard to argue with that emotion.
Yeah. Is that something that you struggle with yourself? Just not knowing what caused your child's autism, or is it you just comfortable with not knowing?
I'm pretty comfortable with not knowing. Mm-hmm. It's someday we'll find out. Someday they'll find things that that'll answer those questions for us. But that's not the important part. At this point we have a son with autism.
what
I mean? There's no other option. We're not going to trade him in.
Yeah.
We love him. He's a wonderful kid. He's very high functioning. He's smart. He's funny. There are no complaints about the child.
right. Yeah, I think it's interesting. It's like a microcosm for something that I encounter a lot in medicine. And sometimes I think people get focused on wanting to know exactly what happened. And I understand that. But we can't always provide that. And when we can't, we say, okay, well, I can't tell you exactly what's going on, but that we can still focus on ways to make it better.
Sure.
So let's just get you off of this endless search for the ultimate diagnosis cause for that diagnosis and focus on what are some practical things we could do to make it better.
Right. Yeah. We've focused on ways of teaching our child the way other kids behave. The big issue is that, he doesn't know that, if a teacher is talking to a whole classroom of people that he's included as part of the class. He doesn't know to make eye contact with you when he's talking to you. But he learns those things and can learn those things. And it's made a huge difference in his life.
Yeah, people can learn stuff.
Yeah, they can learn stuff.
Yeah,
exactly.
It's behavior. It's not intuitive to him, but he can learn to do it and compensate.
Mm-hmm.
Right, absolutely.
Exactly.
Why don't we talk a little bit about how you got involved with the skeptical community itself? What was sort of your path to being here at TAM and being a skeptic?
Wow, that's... That's a long, deep question, isn't it? How long is this show? all jugglers, as it turns out. A lot of the jugglers turned out to be skeptics. I don't know why. And so, and many magicians, as you guys have noticed, there are a lot of magicians involved in the Skeptic Society. I don't know how that got dragged me into it.
Mm-hmm.
I think I've always been a skeptic. I mean, I've never been religious. Just wasn't raised that way. My mother was sent through Catholic school, and that pretty much cured her.
Mm-hmm.
It was pretty clear these people weren't the right nice people you thought they might be. And so that wasn't ever taught to me, and I've never fallen into it.
Mm-hmm.
How I got involved here is, Penn Jillette is also a juggler.
Yeah.
And the juggling community is pretty small. When they were doing a show in San Francisco many years ago, Asparagus Valley Cultural Society, I showed up at their show, and the show was great. Spoke to Penn after the show and said, this is great. I'm a juggling on the street in San Francisco at that time. I said, I'm a street juggler here in San Francisco. And he said, you can't be a juggler. You're dressed like a person. Most of them dress like ninjas or hippie or that kind of thing. And nothing against that, but that's not who I was. So we kind of became friends from that point on.
So there's a juggling community?
Well, there's kind of a limited number of people who do it, really, for some reason. And there are conventions, just like this.
Mm-hmm.
And so we all kind of know each other, especially all the working jugglers all are aware of each other. So,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a community.
A union.
A union, yeah. Right. You know, we used to meet in San Francisco every Sunday morning and talk about our shows and write jokes for each other and stuff. Mm-hmm. So it's a, you know, there's a kind of the core of the juggling performing community for the last 20 years have been all the people that were at this breakfast every day. So,
is that right?
Yeah.
I heard that you juggle chainsaws.
Yeah.
One. How do you start that?
Literally start it or learn it? How do you use a pole? There's a rope on it. I don't know if you've ever seen a chainsaw. Like,
at what point in time does it occur to you, I'm going to throw into the mix a running chainsaw?
Yeah, well, it's a war. It's an escalating war among jugglers is what it is. You know, it started with machetes. And it actually started with torches for me. Mm-hmm. I purchased or built a set of torches at that time, dipped them in Coleman fuel, and stood in my yard and juggled them. And well, that didn't hurt too badly.
What did the neighbors think?
Yeah, you know, the very high hedges at that point. Unfortunately, I didn't burn them.
About torches, I've always wondered.
Right.
You make a torch. How long does a nice torch last? In the movies, they seem to last forever. But, I mean, are they really a good source of illumination?
No. I would not hunt down a monster with one juggling torch. It seems like a bad idea. By the time I got to Frankenstein, it would be time to turn it on. It might still be a little warm. You know, you go, here, hold this against your hands. It'll warm you up a little bit.
Infrared radiation coming off there, but that's it.
Yeah, and I can't imagine if, you know, I mean, like in the movies, in the caves, when they're carrying like little bunches of sticks. Yeah, not a chance. Not a chance.
I knew it.
Exactly right.
Bob, are you saying the movies don't always tell the truth?
My gosh.
Well, I went from juggling torches to a hardware store and bought myself a set of machetes and immediately cut myself and bled for 3 days.
Oh, wow.
You know, it was a pretty good cut. And then because I was working as a juggler, it wouldn't heal. Yeah. You know, bang it with sticks every day. So it took days to stop bleeding.
Yeah.
And then a couple weeks after that, I went to a hardware store and picked up axes. They had axes at the store. And, you know, I was looking at the guy at the store, and he said, what are you doing? I said, well, you know, it's okay. I'm a professional juggler. I'm going to thinking about buying a set of 3 axes to juggle. So I'm just going to toss it. It's okay. I'm a professional. And I toss it, you know, and at that point, I had never juggled like a hammer where that really heavy center of balance is so close. And it just came whipping around and snipped off, you know, another chunk of the same finger that had been cut with the knives. And the guy at the store, you know, he couldn't see it. But, man, I had cut the heck out of my I flip this thing and it cuts me and I go, you know what, I don't think I'll take that. That seems fine. Thanks very much. You know, kind of hiding it, stick my hand in my pocket and walk out going, ow, Jesus, God, I'm bleeding like a dog.
That axe is technically used now.
Yeah, so I didn't buy the axe.
You juggle it, you bought it.
So that's how it escalates, you know what I mean? They've, you know, torches, knives, hatchets, sickles, you know, and then... What else could I do? A chainsaw. I'll do a chainsaw.
It's like playing chicken with other jugglers.
Yes,
right?
It is.
So is it running, or is it?
Yeah, it's running. Yeah, it's a running chainsaw. Yeah, it would be silly if it wasn't running, wouldn't it? Right. You know, hey, I'm going to juggle a chainsaw. Well, no, I'm not really going to start it, but you can see that if I did start it and juggle it, it'd be really dangerous. Yeah. It's running, and you know what? It's got a really heavy, it's got the chain on it, so it's got a real weird gyroscopic effect to it, too.
Oh, yeah.
It's a little odd.
Does the gas in there, the gasoline power, you know, does the fluid when it's...
It sloshes.
It sloshes, but does that cause a balance issue?
You know, I don't put very much in it. So, you know, in case I drop it and it explodes, I'd rather...
Well, how precise does it have to be? I mean, I guess that's
it doesn't
the point.
Have to be very precise at all. A misconception is that it's difficult to juggle, like, different weights or things like that, and that's generally not true. You know, it's a little hard in the fact that the chainsaw weighs, I don't know, maybe 10 or 11 pounds. And I juggle it with a couple of other items. The trick was not to really toss the other items up to the ceiling because I was using so much energy and adrenaline on the chainsaw. But, you know, at this point, that doesn't happen.
Gotcha.
You know, after a couple of weeks, you can learn to control that pretty well.
Wow.
Is the chainsaw the apex? Is there anything beyond that that's even nastier than a chainsaw?
Well, you know, I used to juggle with a partner. I was in an act called Fly By Night. And my partner is now juggling... the zappers, you know, shock thing,
tasers.
He's juggling three. I don't know, tasers might be the ones that shoot, but this is
It's just a cattle prodder.
He's juggling three cattle prod things, which will, of course, knock him out cold if he makes a mistake. He's just out, done. The show's over.
Performance is over, right.
And I'm waiting for that video on YouTube, really.
Right.
I think, you know, I keep telling him you should miss it on purpose and get zapped because that will be the greatest video ever. You'll be a huge, huge star if you do that.
That's viral.
That's viral, exactly.
So who's the best juggler in the world?
Anthony Gatto. I met him when he was 7 years old. I was in Ringling Brothers Circus. And maybe it was earlier than that. And I was working in Baltimore. And his dad brought him down. He was a little tiny kid. And the juggling clubs came up to his waist. And he and I passed clubs at that time. And he's continued as a professional juggler since then. That was 30 years ago.
Yeah.
He has a real regimen of practice. And, you know, I focused really on the comedy part of it. And he is focused really on the juggling part of it.
Yeah.
Now, why would you say he's the best? Is it a pure numbers game? He can juggle so many objects and nobody can quite match that? Or is it creativity in putting together his routine?
No, it is a technical. That's a technical question. You know, if you asked who had the best show, that's a different question. And the answer to that is I don't know. That's a personal taste subjective issue. You know what I mean?
So what's the number then? How many things can he juggle?
I think currently 13 rings and 7 or 8 juggling clubs or, you know, those. It's big numbers.
Yeah.
It's big numbers, and it's big numbers with tricks, you know, 5 clubs and doing tricks with them.
Right.
Which is astonishing.
That's incredible.
Yeah. You know, people can pick up and learn to do 3 items in, three balls in 15 minutes and 3 clubs in a week. But, you know, once you start getting into extra numbers, it gets really hard. Mm.
And you have to be aware of every single one of them, or is it the pattern that you're
aware? I'm just looking at the top. Just looking at the top of the pattern, and you recognize where it's going. So your hands work by themselves. If the throw is good, the catch is easy.
Oh, okay.
Right.
So that's the concentration. Hmm. So.
Tell me about your work with Penn Jillette.
They started doing a TV series here out of Vegas called The Sin City Spectacular, which was like a Sonny and Cher variety show. And they hired all of their friends to come in and write for a week because they had to do an hour show every week for, you know, what seemed at that point to be an undetermined amount of time. So me and a few of the other jugglers and magicians and stuff came in and worked with them for a week. And at the end of the week, I just didn't go home. I said, this is just too much fun. I love doing this with you guys. I love the writing. I like hanging out. It's, you know, at that point, there was someone else was the head writer. So we would go to Starbucks, you know, all day. And we would talk about bits and jokes and stuff. And then someone would go home and type it all up for us. And it was pretty great. I ended up creating a lot of bits for that show for them. And so they said, well, you know what? Since you're going to stay anyway, we might as well just hire you and pay you. So I stayed on and did that show for 24 episodes. Mm-hmm. And it was, like I said, greatest thing. It was so much fun. And, you know, met, you know, a lot of celebrities and hung out with Penn and Teller. Dreams of mine were fulfilled. I wrote a bit with Penn and Teller for the Smothers Brothers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, things that as a kid I'd just been, you know, oh my God, the Smothers Brothers are coming in and I get to write jokes for them. It's the greatest day of my life, you know.
Right.
It was just wonderful. Then they got bullshit and asked if I wanted to work on that as a writer. And I did, and I started working on it as a writer. The first day of actual taping, one of the executives from Showtime came and said, you know, we have a problem. To Penn and Teller, said, we have a problem with part of the script. And they said, well, you'll have to go talk to Goodell about that. And the Showtime said, well, you know, we really don't want to talk to a writer about this problem. We, you know, this is a serious problem, and we should handle it with you. And they said, well, no, Goodell's not just a writer. He's also executive producer. And I'm the least confrontational guy in the world. And the next thing I know, the Showtime guy's over there going, you know, we got to change these lines in here. Like, what? Why are you talking to me? I'm the writer. I said, well, you're executive producer too. We got to solve this.
So you got a field promotion?
Yeah, it's a field promotion, exactly right. Because they didn't want to, you know.
That's what Patton used to do. He'd fire his, you know, his majors and his colonels. And you're fired. You're hired.
That's right. Darth Vader and get shot at.
Darth Vader did it, too.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Penn and Vader, both the same sort of hiring plans.
Same height.
And the same breathing.
Right. Well, Bullshit has been an awesome, you know, show for the skeptical community. Thank you.
It's,
no holds barred. Just get it out there.
It's been a joy to do. It's been a total joy to do it.
You know, feel it's like cathartic just to be able to completely rag about the dumbest stuff you can think of?
Yes, at times it is, yes. Most of the time, by the time it gets to the air, it's home movies.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I've spent so many hours on it that, you know, my gosh, I'm so happy to be done. And then people ask me, what episodes did you do this year? And I go, I don't know.
That's like us.
I think we did one on dolphins. I remember dolphins.
Is that there are plans for that show to continue further? I
mean, certainly within our heads there are. Yeah. The ratings this year at season 7 now are higher than they've ever been.
There you go.
Which has never happened in a TV show. It's always the second season that gets the highest ratings, and then it goes downhill. Mm-hmm. And ours has continually built up. And
awesome.
Like I said, in season 7, they've taken a huge jump again. We're, I think, 30% higher ratings than we've ever had.
30?
I know. It's gone wild.
It's a sign of quality.
Yeah, we are getting better at it. You know what I mean? It's definitely easier to write. It's definitely, I think, funnier, a little more insightful. We've definitely got a better handle on it than we did the first couple of seasons. So,
do you have a favorite episode?
Bottled Water, I think, is my favorite. Or the one with the snails. I like the snails on the face.
Yeah, also. Those are both good. Yeah.
But you wasn't know the reason I like them is different than but just like what made me laugh, not what outraged me the most.
Yeah,
you know, saying I really like the people saying, "Gosh, my skin feels great." Yeah, I've got snails crawling on their face, right. And I love the guy we had who played the water sommelier, just laughing in the back of the restaurant, filling bottles of water with
a hose. One, yeah,
you know what I mean. Yeah. That was a great moment in the show for me. So that's my favorite.
Well, Michael, it's been a pleasure having you on the show.
Anytime. Thank you, guys. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, I come up with 3 science news items or facts, 2 real and 1 fake. And then I challenge my skeptical colleagues to tell me which one they think is the fake. Is everyone ready for this week?
Yeah, phone line sure.
Oh yeah!
All right, I think we got some fun items this week.
That was my Kool-Aid man.
Kool-Aid man. Here we go.
Oh yeah!
Oh yeah!
Jay did it better. Item number 1.
Screw you.
A new simulation finds that Type 1A supernova are much more variable than previously thought, casting serious doubt on prior calculations that led to the inflationary universe theory. Item number 2, scientists report that 3 adults treated for severe visual impairment with gene therapy have remarkably improved vision 1 year after treatment. And item number 3, a new study concludes that human ancestors likely developed bipedality as an arboreal rather than terrestrial adaptation, i.e. while still living in the trees.
We didn't need the i.e.
Well, it's not necessarily for you. Bob, please go first.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
You won the I was the first one to make a stupid comment sweepstakes.
I was the first smartass, so.
Come on. Arboreal? All right.
Shut up.
Okay. Let's see.
Arboreal.
Type 1A supernova, much more variable than previously thought, casting serious doubt on prior calculations that lead to the... Yeah, I'm not liking that one. I thought that they vetted the crap out of that. Finding now that they were much more variable, because if they use the Type 1 supernova as a standard candle, if there's a lot of variability that you didn't know about, then that casts doubt on how accurate it is as a standard candle, and then of course to dark energy as well. So I'm not liking that one at all. Let's see, visual impairment with gene therapy of remarkable improved vision 1 year after treatment. Yeah, that's really interesting if that's true. That would be very cool. Because it shows that that the brain can hook back up to the retina even after being a full adult, and I assume that these adults are partially blind and not completely blind, because I would be much more skeptical if they were completely blind from birth, because at that point your brain doesn't know crap about the eyes. So, but I could buy that one. And then let's see, human ancestors developed bipedality in the trees. Yeah, that's kind of weird. You just assume that humans became bipeds, or early humans became bipeds once they hit the ground. But maybe there was some way that you could walk around just using your legs on tree branches with minimal assistance from your arms. Then I could see how a lot of the groundwork for bipedality could have been developed.
Groundwork.
Yeah, in the trees. So that's feasible too, I think. So I'm going to say that the Type 1A supernova one is fiction.
Okay, Jay.
So a new simulation finds that Type 1A supernova are much more variable than previously thought. I don't really know enough about that to comment about that. Scientists report that 3 adults treated for severe visual impairment with gene therapy have remarkably improved vision 1 year after treatment. That's plausible and interesting. And item number three, a new study concludes that human ancestors likely developed bipedality as an arboreal rather than terrestrial adaptation, i.e. while still living in the trees. Thank you for that, Steve.
In the terries.
That's, I don't know. That's plausible, too. So which one shall we go for? I'm going to go for the first one because I know nothing about it.
The supernova.
Yes.
Okay, Evan?
Supernova. Yeah, I mean, I'll just cut to the chase, and the supernova one sounded very peculiar to me for similar reasons as Bob. I thought they had it pretty well nailed down. You'd have to kind of really, I guess, jumble things around a lot. Your whole measuring stick is off, I guess, in that case. And I guess it's not implausible, but unlikely given the three choices, so I'll say that one's fiction.
Okay, Rebecca?
I agree. For me, it was down to the supernova or the bipedality. But, yeah, the one is so well-established, and the other has been the subject of a lot of back and forth over the years, whether, you know, at what point we developed bipedality and for what purpose and how we branched off. So, yeah, I'm going to have to go with the crowd and say that the supernova one is BS.
Okay. Well, why don't we take these in reverse order then, since you all think that one is the fiction. Number three, a new study concludes that human ancestors likely developed bipedality as an arboreal rather than terrestrial adaptation, i.e. while still living in the trees. And that one is science.
Yes.
This is very interesting. This is still still very controversial, too. So the two alternate theories are, one is that we evolved bipedality mainly while our ancestors were still living mainly in the trees. And again, so walking along branches while maybe holding on with their arms, as opposed to being, you know, completely quadrupedal, coming down to the ground and then either evolving directly to bipedal, or still another alternate is evolving knuckle walking first and then bipedality. Now, knuckle walking is what modern chimps and gorillas do, right? They walk on their knuckles, right?
And Jay, when he's had too much to drink.
Now, or lacking sleep.
It's been known for a long time, or believed, I should say, that knuckle walking is not necessarily a transitional stage between quadrupeds and bipeds. So our ancestors did not have to pass through a stage of knuckle walking, but there is some evidence to suggest that maybe they did. Some researchers argue that both chimps and gorillas are knuckle walkers, and therefore if their common ancestor were a knuckle walker, then by necessity human common ancestor was as well, because that's the three of us share a common ancestor. However, these researchers say that chimps and gorillas have different anatomical structures in their wrists.
Oh.
That, and therefore they may have independently evolved knuckle walking. Therefore, it's not a feature that they would have shared with their common ancestor, with humans, right? So that can eliminate that line of argument from saying that we have evolved from knuckle walkers. What this new analysis did was look at chimps, gorillas, and monkeys. And they found that they have some bone structures in common that, again, that cast doubt on the sequence in which knuckle walking was evolved. So lending support to the evolving bipedality in the trees alternative hypothesis. However, the knuckle walking advocates came back and said they excluded certain anatomical features from their analysis that, when you consider them, favor the common knuckle-walking ancestor hypothesis. So I always find it really fascinating to follow these kind of controversies getting hashed out by different groups, because it really shows science at its best. They're making evidence-based arguments, and their contentions are something that can and eventually will be resolved by the evidence. They make testable predictions. They will be tested. And in 10 or 20 years or however long it takes, there'll be probably a consensus.
Steve, you missed another option.
What's that?
Aquatic apes learning to walk in the seafloor.
Oh, my God. How many emails have we gotten about that recently?
It's funny that you bring that up, the aquatic ape theory. Awesome. I don't want to get into that now because that's
it's a zombie theory.
But I think zombie apes.
Let's talk about that in a future episode in detail because that'll be fun to really dive deep on the aquatic ape theory,
so to speak.
Yeah,
but let's not talk about it anymore today, right, except to say that that's kind of a crank theory that we'll talk about in the future. So that one is science.
That ought to wet their palate.
Let's go to number two. Scientists report that three adults treated for severe visual impairment with gene therapy have remarkably improved vision 1 year after treatment. And that one is...
science.
Also science.
Wow.
Very cool.
Yes, very cool. Now, this is interesting. You know, gene therapy is still really in its infancy, and it's run up against a lot of obstacles. It's
major obstacles.
Yeah, the development of gene therapy has been a lot slower than we had hoped 10 or 20 years ago. Mainly, you know, using viral vectors which cause infection has been the big stumbling block, and figuring out other ways of getting the genes into the cells that need them. But this application actually makes a lot of sense. So these were three people all in their 20s, I believe, when they were treated. They have a specific disease, which is a genetic disease, called Leber congenital amaurosis, or LCA. And it's a hereditary condition in which they have an abnormal gene for a protein that is normally made in the light-sensitive photoreceptor cells. And the lack of this protein makes their retina starved for a specific form of vitamin A, and therefore they can't function, which then severely impairs their vision. So this is the perfect candidate for genetic therapy. The mutation causes an abnormal gene which results in the lack of a protein. So all you need to do is get the gene in some of the cells so that they'll crank out this protein and replace the missing protein, which will then have its missing effect and restore the lost function. So that's sort of the easiest type of thing to target with gene therapy. And it, in fact, has worked in these three cases. And this is now a one-year follow-up, and it shows that it's still working. They're still having improved vision, remarkably successful. So that's great. Of course, this is, you know, just one cause of blindness, and it's a minor cause, I think.
Yeah,
all things considered.
It's pretty cool, Steve. I had read this a couple hours ago. This story,
you bastard.
And, come on, man. It's hard. But this one, it was interesting because it shows that it works so well that the brain kind of recognized that, oh, wow, this part of the retina is now at a sufficient functionality that the brain started paying attention to it.
Yeah.
And in a sense.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good proof of concept. And, you know, it certainly is emerging as a successful treatment for this specific disease. And I think... there are, you know, a lot of genetic diseases work in this basic way that you're essentially missing the protein that's made by a gene, and all you have to do is just replace that gene.
Yeah.
Of course, this all means then that a new simulation finds that type 1A supernova are much more variable than previously thought, casting serious doubt on prior calculations that lead to the inflationary universe theory is fiction. But not as crazy as I think you guys made it out to be, in that...
Yeah, defend yourself or whatever. No,
you guys hit upon exactly why this is not true.
But it's not completely inconceivable.
It's not inconceivable because, you know, the whole notion that the universe is expanding and that therefore we need this dark energy to account for the expansion is accelerating.
Right.
And
that
to account for that acceleration, we had to create this concept. There must be some dark energy out there that's counterbalancing the gravity of the mutual gravity of all the matter in the universe. That's based on making very precise measurements of, again, the expansion of the universe over time. And that precise expansion is definitely dependent on our standard candles, perhaps the most important of which is the type 1A supernova. So if we did find that it was highly variable or more variable than we thought, that could, in fact, you know, if the error bars were big enough, that in fact could seriously call into question even something as basic as the inflationary universe. You know,
that would have been the biggest psych in the history of cosmology. Like, oh, sorry.
I don't think that's outside the realm of possibility given our current state of knowledge. I mean, I think it's a pretty reasonable conclusion right now.
But they actually, there is, I mean, these standard candles, these type 1A supernovas, they're not cookie cutter identical. There are subtle variations that they took into account. the article on here. I got lucky this week because this is another article that I made sure that, yes, this cast doubt on future refinements of the theory.
Exactly.
But the past theoretical predictions and statements are still dead on, and this does not cast any doubt on that.
Yeah, so to clarify, so here's the truth. Type 1A supernova do vary. The quick background is these are supernova that result from a star slowly accumulating material, like a white dwarf or a burned-out star, slowly accumulating material from a nearby star. And when it gets to a critical mass where its structural integrity can no longer withstand the force of gravity based upon the mass, it collapses in on itself and then explodes as a supernova. Now, because they all explode when they get to the same mass, they're all roughly the same absolute brightness. You know the absolute brightness, you can therefore calculate the distance, right? You know, because you can measure the apparent brightness. However, there's some variability to the brightness depending upon asymmetries and exactly how, I guess, the star collapses and how matter is pouring into it, etc. And those subtle differences do affect our measurement of the distance. So if you use enough observations of type 1A supernova, it'll all average out, as long as you're making a sufficient number of measurements. However, kind of very clever, they thought what they're concerned about is that there may be a systematic bias. For example, let's say that the relative proportion of different molecules is different over historical time in the galaxy, right? That means the farther away we look in space, the farther back in time we're looking, and type 1A supernova may be different systematically as we look farther away and farther back in time, just because the stuff of the universe was different back in time. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah,
really interesting. Yeah, so that would have interested. So that's an effect that would not average out. That would be a systematic bias in our. And so they're saying that. So one thing is that they have to get greater precision in accounting for the variability in 1A supernovas. And they also want to make sure that they rule out any of these systematic biases. The reason for this is that they need to make more precise measurements of distance if they are going to be able to further our understanding of dark energy.
Yeah, that was cool.
So good job, everyone.
Thanks, Steve.
Evan, can you play Who's That Noisy from last week?
I'd be happy to. Here it is.
Your birthday today, Daisy. This year you have to make a choice between two life paths. Second chances come your way. Extraordinary events culminate in what might seem to be an anti-climax. Your lucky numbers are 84, 23, 11, 78, and 99. What a load of shit.
All right, and as so many of you correctly guessed, that was Clint Eastwood from his last movie, Gran Torino, playing his character Walt Kowalski.
Yeah, that was an easy one this week, Kevin.
It was easy, but it was for a couple of reasons. It was followed up by a hard one, which nobody got the week before. And that line is just, I think, just too awesome.
And who got it first?
Oh, the first person to get it was our friend from the message boards, Trinoc, T-R-I-N-O-C.
Well, thanks. What do you got for us this week, Evan?
Well, let me just go ahead and fire it up here, and you can guess Who's That Noisy.
Alrighty.
Psychics is another one, by the way. If there's anything in it, it would be a significant genetic advantage for them to become more sexually successful over the last 2,000 years, and we would evolve to the point where there were many, many of them.
Yeah.
Okay. So, that one's not as easily searchable for the answer, but...
It's pretty cool what he was saying.
Thanks, Evan.
Yes, thank you.
No problem. Good luck, everyone.
Jay, what's your quote for this week?
Creationists make it sound as though a theory is something you dreamt up after being drunk all night. Isaac Asimov!
That's a good one.
Isaac said that.
Wow. Jay, you jumped into the deep end without floaties or anything on that one. You just went right for it.
It's good.
No,
you just went for
no
it.
No pomp and circumstance.
Thank you all for joining me. Pleasure as
Thank
always.
You, Steve.
It was a pleasure to
Our
be joined
pleasure.
To you.
Hey, Steve.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by the New England Skeptical Society in association with the James Randi Educational Foundation and skeptchick.org. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. For questions, suggestions, and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by voting for us on Dig or leaving us a review on iTunes. You can find links to these sites and others through our homepage. Theorem is produced by Kinetto and is used with permission.